This is the Everything Financial Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to listen in today, as I usually do. Today, I will be interviewing two guest experts. Actually, I caught up with these guest experts over the past 10 days or so. Joining me momentarily will be Mr. Alistair McLeod. Alistair is an economic researcher and writer and forecaster that I am very, very pleased to have on the program as a first-time guest. He'll be joining me momentarily. And on the second part of today's program, I will be joined by Jeffrey Tucker. Jeffrey is the Director of Content for the Foundation for Economic Education. I caught up with him during the recent Democratic National Convention. He had some interesting things to say. I always like to talk politics and economics with Jeffrey. And if you'd like to have another resource, if you'd like to get another opinion or another perspective, I would invite you to become a subscriber to my Portfolio Watch newsletter. The good news is the subscription is free. To become a subscriber, all you need to do is visit the website, yourportfoliowatch.com. That's Y-O-U-R, yourportfoliowatch.com. We will sign you up for the free newsletter subscription, and then every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern, you'll get the most recent issue of Portfolio Watch. So again, the website is your, Y-O-U-R, portfoliowatch.com. I'm pleased to have, as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Alistair McLeod. I have read Mr. McLeod's work for a long time, so it's a pleasure to interview him, and I've had several recommendations from past guests to get Alistair on the program. Mr. McLeod has been in the finance industry for 40 years. He is the head of research at Gold Money, and he's a prolific writer and economic commentator. And Alistair, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Welcome.
It's very much my pleasure, Dennis.
Well, let me start, Alistair. If you look around the globe, it seems that central banks have the, I guess, proverbial printing press running. Just depends where and when you want to look since the financial crisis. What's going to be the end game here?
Well, we're sort of moving towards it. They have pursued every last channel that they can think of, bar one, and that's probably the final one, and that's helicopter money. Every attempt to stimulate the economy, whether you're talking about Japan or Europe or America or Britain or wherever, basically has failed. And it's failed for one very simple reason, which nobody in the central bank seems to understand, and that is if you debase the currency, you actually make people poorer. So the question is, how are you going to get an economy to improve if you're going to impoverish people? They can't answer that question, and that is the fundamental problem. And the more they do it, the worse the situation is. And we're beginning to see that self-evidently as more and more monetary stimulus is applied. It seems to be having less and less effect, or even contrary effects.
So, Alistair, let's talk about some of this emerging evidence. Certainly, among the masses, there is a bit of unrest. The recent Brexit vote, which I'm sure you're intimately familiar with, is just one example. Are we going to see more of this this public outcry, if you will, via referendums and demands for change moving ahead?
Well, I think we're certainly going to see more of that in Europe, because Britain isn't the only country whose people are unhappy with the status quo. There is a referendum in Italy, for example, in October, when Mario Renzi wants to get support from the people to go against the EU rules and be able to inject capital into the banks so that the banks don't fail. As the situation stands, you know, if a bank looks like failing, then the only thing the state can do is bail it in, not bail it out. And the problem with bailing in the Italian banks is that the bonds that have been sold to try and bolster the balance sheet have really been bought by the retail market in Italy, not the institutions, as would be the case elsewhere. So you can see there's a horrendous mess there. The Spanish are also trying to keep their country together with the Basques wanting independence. The French are pretty unhappy as well. I mean, they've got 10% unemployment. It's actually quite difficult to find anywhere in Europe where people are happy, to be to be straightforward about it.
So do you expect to see that one of the next things that will happen in Europe is that the EU will certainly cease to function as it exists today?
I think eventually that will happen, but of course the authorities will have to be dragged kicking and screaming in that direction. Their immediate response to the current situation as it deteriorates will be to introduce more and more control over the economy and over what people do. So they will actually make the thing worse, and it will become a lot more uncomfortable for people. The seeds of rebellion are there, unfortunately, because with really no real democracy in Europe, because that's not the way the Brussels works. The Brussels works with an unelected commission. People without democracy, I think, have really got only one thing to do, and that is they demonstrate, and they probably become violent eventually. And you can see that the refugee problem is developing this aspect, if you like, of society in France, where they're deliberately trying to stoke up right-wing resentment, and with quite a lot of success, I would guess.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're chatting with Alistair MacLeod. Mr. MacLeod has been in the finance industry for 40 years, and he is the head of research at Gold Money. And Alistair, you'd mentioned the last attempt to stimulate might be helicopter money. For our listeners that might not be familiar with exactly what that term means, could you explain?
Well, at its simplest, what happens is that the central bank credits all our bank accounts with some money in the hope that we go out and spend it. Of course we go and spend it. Basically what happens is that you immediately drive up prices. So if you give everybody 10% extra money, if I, you know, just thinking of a very straightforward example, then you're going to drive up prices. So you're going to get instant inflation rather than an increase in productivity or an increase, well, you get the increase in demand, but of course you won't have the productivity to match it. So what happens to prices? They rise. It doesn't actually resolve anything, but you've got economists in the central banks who are actually getting quite desperate about the current situation, and I'm afraid, as they've already shown, they will try almost anything.
So is the end result of this, Alistair, are we going to see a whole bunch of Zimbabwes moving ahead where we see failed currencies?
I'm afraid that's the most likely outcome. I put it slightly differently. Instead of inflation, I mean, inflation for most people is the evidence of prices rising. But really what's happening when that occurs is that the purchasing power of money is going down. It's not that prices are rising, it's just that what you measure it in, the money you measure it in, that money is going down. And the only thing that sustains any value in paper money is the fact that people actually want it, and they are prepared, if you like, to give it a value. If circumstances develop in such a way that that value is questioned, then you get onto a slippery slope where people change their preferences from holding some money so that they've got a reserve to buy goods into a situation where they're desperately keen to get rid of any money because they see its purchasing power going down. Now, that essentially is the condition behind what we familiarly call hyperinflation. It's actually quite hard to see with all the policies of central banks to try and devalue their currencies, to depreciate their currencies, to reduce the purchasing power of their currencies, how the currencies actually will survive long term. So I do see that as an eventual outcome, I'm afraid.
And Alistair, we've got about a minute left in this segment, and certainly if someone had asked me at the time of the financial crisis, if the Federal Reserve here in the United States could print over $4 trillion out of thin air, I would have said, I don't think so. I'd have been wrong. So I understand with that as a backdrop that this is a difficult question perhaps to answer, but what do you see as the timing on all this?
Well, timing is difficult, but it's getting a lot closer. I mean, having said that, this is been something that's been developing for the last 70 years, certainly since the Second World War and arguably since the Fed was invented back in about 1912. So, in terms of history, it's quite a long perspective. But I do feel that in terms of time, we're getting quite close to it, because the next round of massive monetary injection, I think, is going to undermine the currencies. And we're not very far from that event.
Well, the bad news is we're out of time in this segment. The good news is I have another segment with Mr. Alistair MacLeod, and we will continue Everything Financial Radio after these words. Well, I certainly hope you're getting a lot out of my conversation with Alistair MacLeod. He is a terrific guest with terrific insights, and I hope to have him back on the program again very soon. I'm chatting today with Mr. Alistair MacLeod. Alistair's been in the finance industry for 40 years. He is the head of research at Gold Money. I have been a longtime reader and fan of his perspective. And Alistair, moving ahead, given that you're seeing and projecting that we'll start to see some currency failures at some point, Let me just take a bit of a contrarian view, and as unlikely as this is, assuming these central banks were to stop printing, or we had a currency that was suddenly tied to gold, so there was actually an honest currency, would you then say that we would be more likely to see a deflationary event when measured in terms of current currencies?
That's a very good question. You could well, for a short period of time, in either of those cases, see a deflationary situation developing. The real problem behind this, and this is why they're printing money, really, is that there is far too much debt around. And the creation of debt is something that is accelerating. Now, so not only have you got to stop creating debt as a means of doing business, as a means of buying off whatever it is you're trying to buy off, you actually have to sort of stop the acceleration of it. So the immediate shock of such an event would be absolutely enormous. But I would question the supposition that that's going to happen, really on the grounds that no central banker is likely to try and trigger, as a deliberate act of policy, a deflationary event. So he will continue to produce as much currency as is really needed. Now, of course, he will price that currency on interest rates, and it could be that as inflation gets hold, in other words, rising prices, falling purchasing power of money, as that gets hold, central banks will be forced to raise interest rates. And, of course, it is the nominal interest rates that indebted businesses pay. And so that could quite quickly lead to failures. I think that's a more likely scenario than the one that you have described. As to tying it to gold, I think that is extremely unlikely. Firstly, because the central banks don't really want to part with their gold. They won't exchange it. There is a possibility that either China or Russia might do it at some stage in the future, but we have yet to see how their gold policy relative to their fiat currencies is to evolve.
And Alistair, going back to the comment you just made, the China-Russia comment, that they might be most likely to, at some point in the future, tie their currencies to gold, there seems to have been a pretty big move in that direction of late, at least from my perspective, and correct me if you see things differently, but China now having the Shanghai fix, their own gold market in April. Certainly China and Russia have been accumulators of gold for a long time. Do you think that eventually they would like to get economic dominance around the world by, you know, catapulting their currencies to reserve status by using that tactic?
I have no doubt they want economic dominance. The means by which they get it is something which, at the moment, we're not likely to know. All I would say is, Dennis, you are right in that they have been acquiring gold, and China has, in fact, been acquiring gold since 1987, and my belief is that they have substantial undeclared holdings, not held as reserves, but held, if you like, off balance sheet, if I can put it that way. And consequently, really what we have got is a geopolitical game of strategy, which is being played, if you like, in Confucian terms by the Chinese, and we're being rather clumsy in this. They keep on getting the advantage on us. And we now have a situation where demand for gold is beginning to rise in the West, and that is transferring substantial wealth to China and Russia, certainly on their declared currency reserves, but I would also argue, particularly in the case of China, on their undeclared reserves, because I think they do have substantial quantities of gold. And remember also that we do know that the Chinese people have been encouraged as a deliberate act of economic policy by their government to accumulate gold personally, put some of their savings in gold. The result is that since 2002, when the Shanghai Gold Exchange was established, ordinary people in China have accumulated some 12 or 13,000 tons of gold. Now, that is more than the officially stated gold reserves of the United States.
That's quite an eye-popping number when one puts it in that context. So let me ask you, moving ahead, I'm sure many of our listeners are dying to know, what's your ultimate forecast for gold?
I never forecast prices because what we're doing is we're talking about the purchasing power of money going down. The purchasing power of gold is a lot more stable than it is than that of paper money. I mean, a barrel of oil cost roughly the same back in 1970 as it does today, measured in gold. But of course, in dollars, it's moved from something like $3 a barrel or less up to, what are we now? We're about 41, having been up to 140. So you can see where the volatility lies. So my forecast basically is the purchasing power of paper currencies is going to go down and down and down, will probably accelerate and eventually wipe out any value in them whatsoever. That is the way I would look at the price of gold.
So let's go back maybe, and just one historical example comes to mind. You look at Weimar Germany after World War One, and they printed money massively. Eventually, the currency failed in 1923, I believe, and they replaced the mark with a Renten mark, which was tied to land and industrial goods. So do you see, as currencies fail, do you see that there will be a return or maybe a reset towards a currency system backed by tangible assets?
I would certainly expect a reset. This backing by tangible assets is actually a bit of a myth, because if something is going to be backed, so backed, then you have to have the option of being able to convert your currency into those assets. There's absolutely no such promise from the German government in 1923. And so really what they did was they perpetrated, in a sense, a confidence trick, if you like, on the people. But people do want money. They want a money. They need a money. So they needed to believe in something. And that was actually what Mr. Schach achieved. And he perpetuated that situation by refusing to open the printing presses every time some crisis came along or there was a requirement for money. He just, as I understand it, he sort of sat in a room and he didn't even answer the telephone, such as it was in those days. And that's what we need. We need hands off from the central bankers. Then we could probably have a reset. But that, I think, we're a long way from that so far.
So moving ahead, assuming we see the value or purchasing power of paper currencies continue to decline, which I think we can all agree will happen. What do you think about equities? Are equities going to be a place to hedge against inflation, or are metals the only place that you would advise people to park their assets?
Well, equities that can survive higher interest rates and the effect on the cost of their debt, and if they can survive in the sense that they're making things that people will still want under straitened circumstances, then those shares should do fairly well because they will be a hedge against the falling purchasing power of money. I mean, you've only got to look at the share prices of shares in places like Argentina, and you see that effect writ loud and clear. The other thing that happened in the Weimar Republic was that foreign students, out of their allowances, actually lived like kings because their foreign currency, which they were given by their parents from abroad, allowed them to spend very, very freely, and the purchasing power in local currency, of course, rose very, very substantially. And there were recorded instances of students even buying houses out of their weekly allowance towards the end of 1923. So anything tangible is the answer. And going back to your question about equities, so long as the company can survive the circumstances of a collapse in the paper currency, then the shares will be a very good protection.
Well, unfortunately, we have to leave it there. We are out of time. Our guest today has been Mr. Alistair MacLeod. He is the head of research at Gold Money. Alistair, fascinating conversation. That 19 minutes went by so quickly. I'd love to have you back.
I would love to be back, Dennis. Thank you very much for asking me.
Give me your money.
Well, thanks again to our special guest expert today for joining us, Mr. Alistair MacLeod. And now I'll get to the conversation that I had during the recent Democratic National Convention with Jeffrey Tucker. Jeffrey, as I said, is the director of content for the organization, the Foundation for Economic Education. If you happen to listen to last week's podcast, I did an interview with Mr. Larry Reed, who is the president of that organization. And I'll get to my conversation with Jeffrey right now. I'm very pleased to be joined once again on the Everything Financial Radio program by Mr. Jeffrey A. Tucker. Jeffrey is Director of Content for the Foundation for Economic Education. He's also the Chief Liberty Officer and founder of Liberty.me. And Jeffrey, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Hey, Jeffrey, not long ago, this conversation is actually being recorded on the last day of the Democratic Convention, and we were chatting a bit before we started to record our conversation about President Obama's comments. They sounded a bit libertarian.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. You know, I absolutely love that speech, and I'm not a fan of Obama, but I tell you what, you know, what's happening is the Democrats are trying to figure out a way to attack Trump. And it's pretty weak to say we have a better central plan than Trump has. You know, my policies are better than your policies. I mean, that's boring. It's not very plausible. One of the reasons that the extent to which Obama remains unpopular and that Hillary Clinton is unpopular is just a general fear that many people have that she's got big plans for our lives and we don't really want to go along with them, whether it's, you know, further socialization in healthcare or for surveillance and more foreign wars or goodness knows what else with the economy. She's sworn that she's going to take down the ride sharing and the gig economy and so on. So, I mean, there's a fear of her own despotism. But here's the thing. These are clever people. And Obama figured out what is the weakest point in Trump's whole kind of persona, and it really comes down to a fear that he's a possible despot. You know that he's a braggart and an arrogant man who will assume more power unto himself than any man should have. So last night, this was the tact that Obama took. He said, "Look, we're born to be free." He quoted the Declaration of Independence, and he used these incredible six words. He said, "We don't look to be ruled. We want to govern ourselves, you know, and achieve our own vision of progress, not that imposed by." He even said, "You know, he used the words not by a communist or a fascist, a jihadist, or a homegrown demagogue," I think is what he said. Well, this is the kind of language that any lover of liberty is going to celebrate. So he was very powerful and very penetrating, even if wholly contradictory of everything he's done for the last 8 years.
Yeah, I was just going to say, there seems to be a huge disconnect between those words and what we've actually seen. So
That's right. But you know, politics, you know, everybody can turn on a dime. You know, 8 years of overweening, you know, governance, expansion of government power in every area of our lives, suddenly at the twilight of his second term, he announces that we don't look to be ruled. This is a country based on the ideals of freedom and equality, and we're out to make our own vision of progress, and we don't need despots, jihadists, fascists, or communists running our lives. So I thought it was fascinating, and really it illustrates to me just how much the American character is really built on the idea of individual liberty, and that any truly effective politician has to eventually tap into that sensibility and sell himself or herself as a liberator, not as a despot. And this is, I think, the biggest vulnerability that Trump faces, and I think the Democrats are smelling it. And they're trying to figure out a way that they can come back, because it's not looking good for Hillary Clinton right now, and this is the direction they're taking. Nonetheless, I think we can learn from it. Liberty is the theme of American life, and it always has been. We've not always stuck with it. It's always been imperfectly expressed. But this is ultimately what is at the core of our national character, who we are as people, and what we aspire to as human beings.
So, Jeffrey, you recently published an article on Frederick Douglass, speaking of individual liberties. Perhaps you could share a bit about that article with the listeners.
Yeah. Well, a lot of this, I'm very interested in Frederick Douglass, because he's an American hero. He was born in 1818. He ran away from his master in Baltimore, Maryland, made his way all the way to New York, wasn't safe in New York, made it all the way to Massachusetts among all the abolitionists, and eventually obtained his freedom, and then went on a speaking tour against slavery, and wrote some very powerful books about what it was like to be raised as a slave. And they're really interesting books. You can get them free on Gutenberg. He's really a great 19th century American hero and a great champion of human rights. But he's highly regarded by everybody across the political spectrum. But I don't think his motivations are well understood. And I was really intrigued to read about this, the story of his own liberation and his escape. And, anytime you try to get away from a condition of slavery, you have to develop a consciousness, that I don't have to be a slave, that I'm a human being like any other, and therefore entitled to volition, freedom of association, and, very crucially, the right to keep what you earn. And it was this last point that finally inspired Douglass to take that enormous risk of running away and obtaining his own freedom.
So Douglass, as a slave, was kind of hired out, if you will, or loaned out or rented out, maybe would be a better term, by his master?
So that's right. This is what happened. If the master came to trust a slave, fundamentally, and also where that slave had obtained a great deal of skill that wasn't necessarily directly needed by the master, then it was a common thing, rare, but widely done, rare on a typical plantation, because keeping the property was a priority for all slave owners, of course. We had national laws against running away. You had to return the slaves when you found them, and so on. But he became very good at caulking. Now, this is a term they used in the 19th century. I'm not entirely sure what it refers to. I think we know what caulking is today. My guess is it had something to do with brickwork or fence building, or maybe it was entirely indoors. Whatever it was, he's very good at caulking, and his master didn't really have a need for that service, so he saw that there was an advantage to sort of lending him out and letting him go find work, and then returning to give his master the earnings, and then his master would keep him, keep the earnings, or at least a portion of it, and give back to Douglass or to any slave some portion as a sort of reward or incentive to go back. So this is lucrative, essentially, for slave masters, because they owned a piece of property, and they wanted it to obtain its highest value. So it was very much to the advantage of the master to do this. And he did this with Douglas. And it was interesting because it was this event that really gave Douglas a sense of his own personhood. Because when you're out working in the commercial world and because of your labor, somebody pays you, they're saying to you, you're a valuable human being. Your hands have created value for me, and without that work, this value would not have been created. So Douglas felt a profound sense of consciousness of his worthiness as a human being through commerce. And I think that's really significant, because I think it's underrated the extent to which commerce actually does reinforce our value as human beings. Now, of course, every human being's value, every human being is worthy of dignity, and everyone should feel that way, but commerce gives a chance for us all to experience this in a very real way. This is one of the reasons I think it's a terrible thing, high unemployment rate among youth in this country, why it is we forbid child labor and all this kind of stuff. I think this is very bad. I think children ought to be working from an early age. Not because they ought to be exploited, but because they ought to have a sense of their own value and gain an appreciation for what they can do for others and how they can be rewarded for this. So Douglas felt this for the very first time, but he also felt a profound sense of resentment when his owner took away all his earnings and then gave him back a portion. And he writes in a very interesting way. He says that it finally occurred to him when the owner took all of his money and then gave a portion of it back to him, that it was his owner's way of acknowledging that actually Douglas deserved the whole of it, and that no man has the right to take away from anyone, another man, the fruits of his own labor. And Douglas writes this. I mean, in effect, what you see happening here in his mind is he's considering being a tax rebel, And it was this that inspired him to finally obtain his own freedom. And I can tell you some more details about how that happened. But I think it's extremely important for us to realize that the right to keep the products of your own labor is an essential part of freedom. And again, let me just point out, this is 1838. Long before anybody would have ever conceived of such a thing as the income tax.
Which brings me to a question about tax policy that I will ask you after the break, because the bad news is we're out of time with Mr. Jeffrey Tucker, but the good news is we have him for a few more minutes after the break. Stay with us. This is Everything Financial Radio. The good news is we have another 6.5 minutes with Mr. Jeffrey Tucker, so let's jump right back in. I'm chatting today with Jeffrey Tucker. Jeffrey is the Director of Content for the Foundation for Economic Education. And Jeffrey, the website fee.org has a new look and is a great resource. Why don't you fill the listeners in?
Yep. Well, we've redesigned the whole thing. We're publishing 5 to 10 articles a day, staying on top of the news cycle. It's becoming a regular newsroom around here, and I'm thrilled about it. I mean, the chance to run a major website like this where the theme is human freedom and to talk about it day in and day out, I never get tired of it. I love it. We're now getting about 1 million visitors a month to the website, and we have tens of thousands. I think we're up to like 40 or 50,000 now daily subscribers to the email list, and people just love it. So if you go to the website, you'll be prompted to put in your email address. I think you'll benefit from it immensely. Better than the New York Times, I can tell you that.
Well, Jeffrey, that's a rather low bar. let's jump back in and talk. We were talking prior to the break about Frederick Douglass, and you refer to him as Frederick Douglass, the tax rebel. Jump back in.
Yeah, okay, so here's what happened. So so he started feeling more and more free. The more he began to work, the more he began to earn. Finally, his master settled on $3 a week that Frederick Douglass had to deliver, which is a lot of money in those days. And one Saturday night, he decided to go out to a camp meeting. Now, that's his words, a camp meeting. I don't know what a camp meeting was. Maybe there was like a picnic or just a party or a singing and dancing, maybe swimming in the river. I don't know. But he stayed out too late. His master got upset with him and punished him very severely. Frederick Douglass was very annoyed by this. And so the next week, he didn't work at all and just announced to his master that he didn't have any money to give him because he didn't work. Well, that made his master ever angrier, and Douglass thought, well, this isn't really working. So he thought, what if I go the other direction? What if I work so much and overpay my master that I earn his trust, and work so much that I can actually earn enough money, keep some for myself, enough to earn a ticket on what was then called the Underground Railroad? So that's what he did. So he started working extra hours and working extra hard, and ended up delivering to his master on a routine basis $9 a week, thereby earning his trust and getting removing suspicions on the part of the master that he might want to run away. And then he plotted his escape. He ended up saving enough money to get a ticket out and made it to New York and then finally to Boston. He became a great spokesman for abolition in the 1840s and 1850s. Truly a great story of human freedom. But I think that the critical aspect of this story is not just a sort of ontological freedom. Yes, people need to be free, but I think commercial freedom and the right to own, to earn, and to own property is how freedom manifests itself most directly in our lives. And that was certainly true with Frederick Douglass. And I'm afraid this message has been lost on all the people who celebrate Frederick Douglass and his anti-slavery positions. They've forgotten that a large part of what drove him to obtain his own freedom was the desire to work and to earn money and to keep every bit of that money that you earn. And truly, that is a major aspect of what constitutes freedom in our world.
So, Jeffrey, just a transition. When you take a look at a lot of the policies, I mean, we could talk about the government monitoring internet activity, just the whole. I don't know if oppressive is the right word. I'm struggling for the right word, but it almost feels that way. Are there some parallels today with us as a country, as a group, to Frederick Douglass's predicament?
Well, I think it's an interesting way to think about it. You know, all of us are experiencing freedom in a way that previous generations didn't have. We all have customized smartphones. We're seeing technology serve us in ways that were unimaginable in the past. We're all getting a taste of freedom, the freedom to communicate, to educate our kids through homeschooling. In practical ways, there are many aspects of our lives that are becoming more free, but in other ways, we're becoming less free. And I think that this toggling between the two is not sustainable. The freer we feel in our daily lives, thanks to technology, the more I think it's going to create a hunger for more freedom. And as Frederick Douglass learned, you know, it's just a matter of deciding. Now is the time. I'm not going to take anymore. I deserve freedom. Then that's when we start getting creative. And I think that that's the next stage in our political development. I mean, you look at the options that were given from the top two parties, and they've just become impossible. I mean, do you really want to choose between Trump and Hillary Clinton? I don't, and apparently two-thirds of Americans agree with me. So what is the next step? It could be third parties. It could be just finding ways to build freedom in your own life. It could mean you know, educating yourself and about what freedom means and achieving a higher level of consciousness and acting on that in every way that is possible through entrepreneurship or Or who knows, maybe that involves migrating. You know, there's a lot of different answers, and the answer is different for every person. But the crucial first step is to realize that what's happening to us is wrong and that there's a better way to live. And Frederick Douglass saw that and acted on it, and I think he remains an inspiration for us today.
Well, that is a terrific place to leave it. Our guest today has been Mr. Jeffrey A. Tucker. He is director of content for the Foundation for Economic Education. The website is fee.org, fee.org. I would encourage you to check it out. And, Jeffrey, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. It's always good to be with you, Dennis, and take care.
Well, that's all the time I have for this week's podcast. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks so much for the kind words. Thank you for telling your friends, telling your family members to listen in as well. I will continue to work hard here to bring you another perspective and bring you information I believe will be vital to navigating the economic landscape as it lies ahead. Thanks again for listening.